This episode is brought to you by MasterClass. MasterClass offers classes on a wide variety of topics, all taught by world-class instructors at the top of their fields. Each class is broken out into individual lessons, usually around 10 minutes long. Members can explore at their own pace, and each class is supported by downloadable materials, class guides, recipes, and more. With MasterClass, you can learn from the world's best artists, icons, and leaders anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace. You can learn about filmmaking from the great Martin Scorsese, or scientific thinking from Neil deGrasse Tyson, or entrepreneurship from Richard Branson. I personally love the class from Chris Voss about negotiation. His experience as a hostage negotiator for the FBI was so interesting, and the way he breaks down communication and body language and behaviors is fantastic. I highly recommend you check it out. This holiday, give the perfect gift of an annual MasterClass membership and get one free. Go to masterclass.com/one today. That's masterclass.com/one. Terms apply. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the One Thing Podcast. I'm Chris Dixon, and today I had a great conversation with Dr. Richard Winters. Dr. Winters is a career physician focusing on emergency medicine working out of the Mayo Clinic, and he's grown into a trainer, executive coach, and developer of future leaders. And what we talked about today was how he leverages the skills that he's seen in his career in those environments to help new and developing leaders sharpen their skills. We talked about what it means to create a shared reality, to identify the fears and worries of your team, and infuse a shared vision of what success looks like in the future. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Dr. Winters. So, hey, everybody, and welcome. We're here with Dr. Richard Winters, who is an emergency physician at the Mayo Clinic. And he's got a new book just released that is a Wall Street Journal bestseller. Congratulations on that. And it is You're the Leader, Now What?, which is leadership lessons from the Mayo Clinic. And as director of leadership development at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Winters delivers programs that train leaders at all levels of healthcare in organizations worldwide. You're also an executive coach. You provide coaching at the Mayo Clinic, from which you have graduated the Alex School of Medicine in 1994 and returned back to the Mayo Clinic in 2015. You served as managing partner for the Democratic Physician Group, department chair of an emergency department, and president of an 800 physician medical staff. And if that's not enough, CEO/founder of a startup managed care organization. That's a long list of pretty cool accolades. Thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, it's great. Do you mind sharing anything else from your background that you think you'd like to share, or anything that brought you here today?
So I was born, and I knew from that moment that I was going to be exactly where I am today. You know, no, not at all. So I was in high school, not the best student. I think I graduated with a C- average. So there's hope out there for any moms and dads who are trying to figure out what's going on with their kids. And from that point forward, just had a lot of experiences that have led me to be where I am right now in front of you.
Oh, that's awesome. And got a new book. It's going well.
Yeah, thankfully. It's nice to write something and have people read it.
Yeah. It's the first step in the battle, right? It's having them read it.
Yep.
That's awesome. Okay, so what has made you want to write a book? What was the inspiration for getting your thoughts on paper, getting out to the world?
Yeah, so I mean, as I graduated from emergency medicine residency, you know, go into practice and start taking care of patients, and then start noticing that there's some inefficiencies and things I'd like to change. And so to change things, you need to start stepping into leadership roles. And I was real good at walking into a patient's room and listening briefly and then writing some orders, you know, not suggestions, orders. And I thought that maybe leadership was going to be similar to that. And lo and behold, it is not at all similar to that. And so this concept of walking into a room full of colleagues and just saying and pointing out what you think should be done, it's really not an effective form of leadership. And so through the process forward, kind of learning how to become an effective leader. And then as I became an executive coach, I started realizing that others were facing the same thing, where we have this expertise, and this expertise is helpful. But then once we become leaders, how do we almost shed our expert experience to be able to move into this concept of facilitating and coaching and being open to exploring possible solutions? And so as I was meeting with colleagues and coaching them, I would find over and over again individuals in these situations where really complex scenarios, thorny challenges where their colleagues are all disagreeing and everyone's looking to this individual saying, now what? And so I wanted to write a book that was going to help leaders kind of figure out those situations, step away from their expertise, and then lead from a perspective of facilitating and coaching.
I love that. You, in some circumstances, perhaps you're a subject matter expert or you excelled in an area that got you into a leadership role. And now you're in this leadership role in this classic mentality of, I tell you what needs to happen because I know everything. And that's just false. Or really, success is more of like, how do you extract from the collective wisdom of your team, create consensus? Like, what are the core skills behind how you create consensus in a room of people that are disagreeing? And it's, I think what you're saying around the skills around facilitation. And I love that. It's an evolution of the way we think about leadership.
Yeah, and it's much understanding some of the structures and the frameworks for how to do that. Just as I'm seeing a patient and there are specific frameworks that I use as I'm approaching things. And many leaders do not have that approach. And then also just the way we're thinking about making sense of the world ourselves and kind of our efficacy there. There are changes that go along as you become an effective leader.
I wanted to ask you about that. So I'm glad you went there. So are there some skills that you developed when working in this environment as a physician that you see have parallels with just general leadership?
Yeah. So I think to kind of go back to this idea of me going into a room and interviewing a patient and then writing an order. I think you can think of an emergency physician as doing that, but actually that's probably not going to be a great emergency physician. The best emergency physician is going to go in the room, ask some questions, and then come out, talk to the nurses, talk to the pharmacist, get other perspective from the family, and really try to not anchor in our decision, that just kind of just comes up in the moment. And so leadership, the same thing. And so it's try to, how do you, each of us has our individual genius. How do we get together with almost the genius of the room, or as what some would call the senius, this collective wisdom before we start to move forward?
Yeah, it's if I'm saying this correctly, like you go into a room and you have to do a diagnosis, like a diagnostic, like what's all the information on the table here, no pun intended on the table, and figure out what's the situation. Don't go on your initial, assumptions, challenge your assumptions, perhaps, like collect all the information before you make a decision. And that's true in leadership scenarios as well.
Yeah. I mean, we all have blind spots. And no matter how good our analysis of a situation, no matter how much data we have, we're still making decisions behind our own blind spots. And so how best to get around that, but by gathering other perspectives before we move forward.
Totally makes sense. And what about the either perceived from the outside, not being a physician, but the perceived stress or kind of high paced, fast paced environment, or does any of that lend itself from your experience to leadership skills?
Yeah, I think it requires agility. So when are you going fast and when are you slowing down? And there are times that a leader just needs to make a decision. I mean, there are times when you have to, you don't have all the information that you'd want, and you just have to decide. And in those moments, I think in your mind, you think about, quickly, what might other people do? What might be other approaches? But you just need to decide. And so that's one kind of decision. But then many kinds of decisions are not that way. Many kinds of decisions are, instead of just moving forward and deciding, you need to pause and reflect and gather this sort of shared reality of perspectives before moving forward. And that agility is difficult for some. Some are very good at just commanding, making decisions. Others are very good at collaborating and maybe gaining consensus. It takes a leader who can do both of those things to really be successful.
I was just going to say, don't you think there's a balance? Because if I've seen strength and opportunity on both extremes there, and on the overly confident, bold decision-making leadership approach, that you're going to miss your blind spots, you're going to overstep, you're not going to be sensitive enough to the information that's out there, and the kind of, for lack of a better term, political relationship building you have to do to gain consensus to get your team bought in your direction. Then the other side of that coin is you play the consensus game forever and never get anywhere, make a decision.
Yeah. Consensus probably isn't the best way for a leader to approach things. It's more like collaboration.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. But I think it is, if that's one of those terms that you think, well, if we can all just pool all of our ideas and then just meet in the middle, generally you need to move forward in ways that have a direction that may be going against what maybe the majority thinks, or maybe 30% of the individuals think. And so collaboration is the proper approach.
How about from a risk analysis or risk assessment, albeit perceived risk or real risk, how much have you been able to draw from being in such a high stakes environment for so many years, and how that kind of parallels over into general leadership?
Yeah, I just want to make sure. So from a risk perspective, I think anytime we're making decisions, there's a risk there. And I think it, again, depends on the situation. And so the risk of not deciding during those times of crisis is that you move forward with status quo, and actually status quo is destructive. And so you don't want to be trapped in those situations. You need to make decisions to try to almost discover how the environment reacts to your decision. And then as you do that, you start to gain some clarity. And so there are times when you make a decision and you're kind of poking the environment and seeing how it responds and moving forward. If you did nothing though, it's your risk goes up. And then on the other hand, as you're making decisions, I mean, there are those times again when you need to bring a bunch of different perspectives together. And we know that our blind spots are actually our risk. And the improvement in our ability to make decisions that kind of meet our goals, you go up maybe 10 to 15% by bringing in those other perspectives. Even during those times when you're making the best decisions, it's oftentimes not going to work out the way that you had predicted. And so how do we remain open to discovery and learning and, again, adapting to those sorts of environments?
Yeah, is that where the component, if I understand from your approach, is like questioning best practice? Like, don't make the assumption that because something's been done, it should continue to be, like, question your assumptions.
Yeah, I mean, I think as we look forward, many of us are in organizations where there's traditions. And so these traditions, on one hand, form the basis of our culture, bring us together. But on the other hand, we need to innovate. And so oftentimes, as you're in meetings with your colleagues, you see this tension, you feel this tension about tradition versus innovation, and individuals will bring up best practice. And it's important for us to remember that best practice is by definition past practice. And so when we're talking about best practice, we're actually talking about things that have worked in the past. Do they still hold? And I think that's a question before you move forward.
Right, just asking that question is the important part, because to your point, I haven't thought of it that way. Best practice is past practice because it was established as a best practice prior to that moment. Yeah, okay. And then we talk about applying that in this innovation space. Any advice for someone who's kind of conflicted around best practice or challenging innovation? You talked about that tension in the room. Like, how can you break through that?
I think the first thing is acknowledging that there is that tension. And so it's so easy for us to think about things in terms of dichotomies and yeses and nos, ones and zeros, this way or that way. But as we're in these really thorny challenges, it's actually all those things are there. I mean, and that's just kind of a part of things. You have disagreement. And from the disagreement in perspectives, there may be multiple options for how you move forward. And you need to recognize that there is no single correct way of moving forward. And we often see that right now in social media, as we're talking about politics and the future of the world and those sorts of things, is it's one side versus the other. It's just not the reality of the way things work. It's really both sides. And how do we look within that gray, all the kind of, bring things together to start to move forward and discover together.
Yeah, I mean, it's just nuance. You have to acknowledge the nuance and the complexity of the scenario. It's not always so binary.
And then also the fears and worries. I mean, we all have fears and worries about what might happen as we move forward. And I think a thing that a leader should not do is try to avoid those fears and worries. Try to keep them in the darkness. Maybe if I don't mention this, maybe if I don't bring this forward, then it'll go away. And these are those monsters that just kind of live in the darkness. And we may decide in the moment and move forward and feel like, yeah, that's good, without acknowledging the fears and worries, thinking that it's going to take time and that maybe we can't answer them all. But if we don't bring these things forward, they will be the monsters that will haunt our future strategic success. And so calling out, what are our fears? What are our worries moving forward? And then as we're establishing vision for how we're going to move forward, purposely calling out ways that we might mitigate or decrease the chance of those fears or worries from occurring, not just jumping over them.
That's a great point. How do you, if you don't mind sharing, how would you facilitate that conversation? There's a couple of things that I think are really valuable. It's okay, let's bring the fears out, let's acknowledge them and have that conversation. Then we talk, you were talking about vision, like where are we going? Once we have an idea of where we're going, how do we mitigate against those fears and worries and you know, work through the roadblocks, acknowledge some blind spots? Like, how would you facilitate that on the front end and bring awareness to the fears and worries?
Yeah, so I think of a process, and I call it roll forward. And the R is we need to develop shared reality, and then next we move to what are the options, the things that we might do, and then finally, what's the way forward? And what we tend to do is we roll backwards. We just jump to the way forward, and then try like all these other things which we've skipped in the you know, thinking it's going to be efficient, then start to haunt us, and we start to think about things. So I think it's first of all understanding that we do need to develop some shared reality when we have these times where we can come together and establish different perspectives. And then honestly, it's just simply calling out, given our challenge and what we're wanting to do, what are the fears and worries we have? And as you do that, so how do you do that in a way that there's some psychological safety? Sometimes you're with a group of individuals that you know and trust, and people will just say their fears and worries. At other times, people are resistant or they don't feel safe. They're worried that maybe you as the leader are going to hold this against them. And so then I think you develop processes where you, in your facilitation, that allow people to raise ideas safely and then report them out. And so this has been one of the great things about this movement from in real life, IRL to URL, right? Our video meetings is now we're using breakout rooms and things like that. And so I think oftentimes what I'll do is I'll, what are the fears and worries? And so write these things down for yourself. Just take a minute or two and think about what are your fears and worries. And then, okay, now get together with a group of three or four colleagues here in the room, whether it's virtual or in real life, and discuss these fears and worries. And then now as groups, let's report out, what are the fears and worries that you heard that came up? And as individuals, as in groups report out, it's no longer now attached to an individual. It may be even something that they've heard about. They don't have to own it, but it's a way of bringing these things up. And as you hear them, you write them down, you document them so that people can see this is what the fear, this is what the worry is. And then as you establish, okay, so now given these fears and worries, given these different perspectives, how might we move forward? You create this vision, and our vision is we're going to move forward in a way that decreases these fears and worries, that leverages the values of our organization. And so now given that, what are the options for what we might do?
That's great. You can tell you're no stranger to workshopping. That's a good framework. So creating psychological safety is a real thing. And it's maybe more of a newer focus, at least in my experience over the years of working in these environments. It's the concept of acknowledging it more broadly, I think, is really great. Because it lets people feel more comfortable sharing, because you'd otherwise have like large dominant voices in the room or people who are just comfortable putting it all out there. And then you suppress the others who are less comfortable sharing. So if I can read that back. So you like journal, have the participants write down individually what comes to mind and like small group share. So you can build a little bit of momentum and then you can do large group share to kind of pull out the biggest takeaways, if I caught that correctly.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think of, if you were to utter the word meeting, I think you'd probably get a collective groan of people like, oh, another meeting.
Right.
In actuality, most of our meetings are not meetings, they're tellings. And so as we're leading meetings, we actually want to meet. We want to come together around ideas, and a way of doing this is having processes that allow us to do this. Otherwise, we're just telling.
Absolutely. Okay, so create a shared reality. That's something I'd like to talk to you about. What does that mean for you? And when we talk about A, what does it mean? And B, like how does it demonstrate value or give value to the process?
And so this is one of the things that attracted me to return to Mayo Clinic was that we lead through dyads and triads. And so what is that? So basically within a department, there is a physician lead, a nursing lead, and an administrative lead. And so as decisions are made, the dyad or the triad come together And each of them has a different perspective. Certainly the nurses are going to have a different perspective from the physicians. The administrators are going to have a different perspective. And it's by pooling these different kind of shared perspectives that you can start to develop shared reality. Whereas me as a physician, I think this is what we should do. Once we gather these shared perspectives, again, agreements and disagreements, we start to see the challenge in different ways that helps us as we start to move forward. Without that, again, we're operating behind blind spots. And so I think executive teams, the same thing, and organizations, we want to figure out what are the shared perspectives? What has not been said? What are the fears and worries? So that we can have perhaps a more accurate perspective of the stage of the arena that we're making the decision.
That's great. And I was going to say, it's like setting the stage appropriately so you can, or a platform to have a good discussion.
Yeah.
Building a winning team is a huge challenge. And if you're hiring, you know the struggle is real. Both in sports and business, building a winning team is all about the people. And ZipRecruiter makes it easier for you to find exactly who you're looking for. Imagine having a talent scout for your team that could bring you the right candidates to fit the needs of your organization. Whether you're looking for a civil engineer in New York, a pediatric nurse in Nebraska, an attorney in Colorado, or even a mascot in Missouri, ZipRecruiter can help you find the perfect match, and they make it simple. It's common to feel like there's too much to do and not enough time. And hiring can take a lot of time. But with ZipRecruiter, it makes the process feel so much more efficient. ZipRecruiter uses powerful matching technology to help find you the right candidate and narrow down the search. And you can try it free today at ZipRecruiter.com/onething. That's ZipRecruiter.com/onething. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
So creating shared reality, you talked about identifying those fears and worries, get them on the table because it's going to inform like what you should address when you think about where you want to go. Is that accurate?
Yeah. If you can restate that again, I apologize.
Yeah, no problem. No. So I'm just trying to process the flow and I hope I'm saying it back correctly, but creating a shared reality so that you're on the same page, you have a nice platform for the discussion, then calling out and identifying what are the fears and worries that you need to be aware of, because having that knowledge will allow you, when you think about where you want to go, like cast a vision for the business, if it's 5 years, 1 year, you know, this quarter, whatever's appropriate, that you can address those as you think about creating a shared vision.
Yeah, because what happens when you don't develop shared reality? What happens is you move forward based on your expertise or the small leadership group's expertise, and then people feel like they're unheard, and that's because they were not heard. And then what happens oftentimes, the leaders say, well, I already thought about this concern that you had, and I'd already thought about this. And it just creates a lot of resistance. And again, you're operating behind blind spots. And so isn't it better to really give the individuals in your organization the voice and then to hear those voices? And we know right now we're talking about burnout and well-being, and we know how entwined a sense of shared reality, of shared purpose and values, a sense of autonomy, you know, a sense of being heard, a sense of being able to help affect the environment that we're working in is. And if leaders aren't giving individuals the opportunity to just be heard as you're moving forward, you're going to really have some issues.
Yeah, it comes to mind, misalignment for sure on at the very least buy-in to the shared vision or purpose, and have people operating in silos or just going after whatever they think is their contribution that may not be in alignment with the shared vision.
So true.
Yeah, and I've seen it. I'm sure you have too.
I've seen it, I've experienced it, and I've caused it. And that's all these things come together about, you know, how to approach things differently.
So you've got the full spectrum of experience to draw from there.
Yes, unfortunately.
Hey, well, sometimes that's what it takes to really be able to share it back. You have to go through it.
Self-acceptance is a big component of being a good leader too.
Lead from the front. You make the mistakes so your team doesn't have to.
That's right.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit more about your book? I'd love to hear like what was the inspiration, the framework? Like how did you go through the process?
I think, I went to business school. And I learned a lot about management and you know, kind of numbers and things like that. But I found that as I was in a leadership position, there were just some big concepts of really, again, about how to facilitate individuals, groups of individuals making decisions, and how to coach one-to-one. And over, as I'm coaching leaders at all levels, in the most senior levels, there are just these themes that just kept coming up. And I like to, like, I think of myself, I used to play guitar in bands and things like that. And I really like the concept of producers. And I think of individuals like Brian Eno or Rick Rubin, who are famous producers. They bring these bands in all with, you know, the lead singer who knows what they're doing and all, you know, everyone has their different voices, but they're able to really bring the best out of a group. And for me, there have been frameworks that have been so helpful for me. And there, I think about the Kinevin framework from David Snowden. I think about the work of Bob Keegan and Lisa Leahy, you know, the immunity to change and adult development and all these sorts of things. And I wanted to create a book that had almost a playlist of things as you're encountering these difficult situations, these frameworks that you could use, that you could bring up in a moment, open up this chapter, and this is how you can approach things. And so really, that was it. It's these now what questions, and well, it's right there.
And hence the name. So you're a leader. Now what? Exactly. And knowing, okay, I'm encountering this challenge. I've got a place I can go to that has a solution for me or an approach, a methodology.
Exactly.
So question, guitar. You play guitar? That was your instrument of choice?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. What's your go-to guitar to play?
I have a Fender Telecaster, actually.
Right, oh, Telecaster. Shoulder. Nice. Okay. That's humbuckers, right? The pickups, if I understand.
Dual humbuckers on this one.
Yeah, I grew up around the music industry. My dad was a producer and for some time in television and music. And I play guitar as well, so big
Sweet.
Fan. Yeah, big fan.
The analogy of a producer, I think, works really well in leadership. Or it's almost the conductor in the orchestra.
Absolutely.
I love how to play the... You may know how to play the music, but it's really bringing these ideas together and then just making them so much better.
It's great. You mentioned Rick Rubin, and I was listening to him recently, and he had made a comment that he was trying to relate the role of a producer on this podcast, and he said it was a lot like being a coach. And I was like, yeah, there you go. So the fact you said that is very interesting.
Insightful. Yep.
Yeah. He believes it to be the same way you do. And what I had no idea, his experience and how many different musicians he'd worked with. That was pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an impressive list and of individuals that I listen to all the time.
Same. Yeah. Same. Okay. So you've got this book. You talked about the way to utilize the book. Is there anything from your experience as a physician in your training that helped inform the structure of the book? Because the what came to mind was the way that you described like a challenge and like that's produced a solution and almost like an operating handbook for a leader going through common challenges. I wonder if there was something from your experience that helped inform the way that you designed the book.
Yeah, I mean, and also I think of it like an arc of a story or like a song, I guess, in some ways. Which is, so first of all, I did not want a book that had a lot of fluff. And there are a lot of books that I've read where it's like, okay, get to it. And then as an emergency physician, I want to go to the next room and see the next patient because I've already gotten enough. And so I wanted it to be concise and get to the point pretty rapidly. And then also be easy to read. And so at the end of the chapters, there's summaries and, you know, what to do and how to reflect on what to do. But it's really, I think there is a flow of how we lead and the things that we face. And those are the problems that we face just in leading ourselves and the way, how do we make sense of the world? And so there was an area that you wanted to talk about there. The one-to-one conversations that we're having with colleagues when people come to you, whether they're in difficulty or whether they're seeking lots of opportunity and how we relate to them. And then finally, just the tactics of how to bring individuals together in the room when someone is interrupting and disagrees with everything you're saying. When you leave the room and you've had a great conversation, but are we actually going to achieve results? And so it's kind of the arc of the way leaders experience the world.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just like you said, the arc or the flow of how things typically progress in a leadership experience.
Yeah, and I like those books where I can just open up a chapter and then go from there. I didn't want to have a book where you had to read the whole book through. I wanted something where you could read any chapter and hopefully get something out of it.
Okay. Yeah. I appreciate that, by the way.
You're welcome.
Okay. So what about leading with a story? And I know that's a piece of the book and What does it mean for you to lead with a story, and why is that valuable in leadership?
Yeah, so this is one of these great strengths of Mayo Clinic. I'm in a basement right now, and I'm recording in Rochester, Minnesota. And Mayo Clinic exists because there was a tornado that wiped out the town in late 1800s. And from there's a story of the sisters and the Mayo brothers coming together to create this organization. And then along the way, there's stories about them going out and learning from others and bringing those learnings back in. There's stories about them meeting the needs of patients. And then each day we're hearing the stories of how we're helping to meet the needs of patients, these wonderful things that our colleagues are doing. And those stories are inspiring, and those stories reflect the values of the organization and the mission. And they really are, it's the thing that holds us together as an organization. And so, yes, innovation is at top of mind and how do we adapt? But this innovation grows from these stories, from the history. And so, yes, we talked about best practices being past practice, but this kind of foundation of who we are and where we're going really is directed by the mission and the values that are reflected in these stories.
Got it. That makes sense. I was going to ask you, and you went there as you put a bow on that. At the end, is the story really helping to tell or define what is the mission and what are the values of the team, a leader, organization, et cetera?
Yeah, and I think any leader, so if you're trying to promote change and you're thinking about how to adapt to challenges, think about the customer you're serving. Think about the individuals within the organization. Think about those stories and then tell the story that you're wanting to achieve and how you're going to get there. It is those stories that bring people together.
Yeah. Do you see the value or benefit of having you identify your story as a leader and bring awareness to the story of the organization that you're working in and trying to seek alignment in those and find the connectivity?
Yeah. I mean, so I think that and if I'm hearing you right, I think the leader has their own story, and the story isn't necessarily, I guess probably it is, like I was going to say, a superhero story where the superhero gets beaten back a couple times, where they make some mistakes, and then eventually you win out in the end. And I think the best leadership stories are where the leader is reflecting on those mistakes that they've made, on the times that they don't know what to do, and on the stories that help them move forward. So I think the leader, the team, the organizational stories are very important.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's something to having visibility into your story. I think that it allows you to be a more transparent leader as well, and sharing that. And for me, knowing what my story is informs, like, okay, well, where am I coming from and where am I going? And is the organization that I'm leading a part of, that I own, that I run, whatever the context, are those two things aligned? And is my story and the story of what we're trying to build in our vision, are those things working together to create a net greater positive result?
A lot of this is normalizing. So a part of writing the book was writing about the dumb things that I've done in the past. And as I know that as I'm giving talks, one of the best ways to connect with the audience is to talk about some of the dumb things I've done, because it normalizes things, because we've all done that and it brings us together. If those were hidden in the background, like, who's this person from Mayo Clinic and why are they talking at me? It's just, I think the more the leaders can embrace and talk about the failures and the difficulties that they've had, the more human they are and the more it allows their colleagues to be human.
Yeah. Yeah. Keith Cunningham, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He's one of the authors we tend to reference on here. But Keith Cunningham wrote a book called The Road Less Stupid. It's a great book, by the way. And he talks about the dumb tax a lot. And I think it's good to bring some visibility to where you've paid some dumb tax, because you could, give yourself some transparency and trust in doing so, but also there's an opportunity to help people not pay that same tax.
Very good.
Yeah. Okay. So I know I keep relating back to your experience as a physician, but I find it really interesting how there could be a potential connection there. So I hope that's okay. But you, I know there's either a chapter or an approach in the book that's taking charge in chaos or taking charge in chaotic environments. Is that coming from experience in what I would assume would be a pretty typically chaotic environment in the hospitals?
Yes, right. And so let's think about that. So let's the differentiation. And this is one of these things where I really rely upon. So David Snowden and his Kinevin framework. Kinevin is C-Y-N-E-F-I-N. And he published a paper in the Harvard Business Review, I believe it was 2008. It just helps me to think about, to kind of map out the decisions that we're making. And there's a difference between when we're in these environments that are unknown and the possibilities are unknown, there's a difference between complex issues with which we have some time to develop these shared perspectives versus the chaos, which is, okay, now no time and you need to make decisions. A lot of people, it's interesting, think of emergency medicine. Oh, emergency physician, it must be chaos and crisis all the time. As someone who's been an emergency physician for 25 years, there's not much that surprises me. And there are a lot of things that fit into frameworks. So a patient, you think about a trauma, someone who gets gunshot or something like that. Oh, that's a crisis of chaos. It's actually, we know there's 20 people in the room. We know exactly what each individual is doing, what their roles are, how things are going to progress. And so those are actually fairly easy decision trees. It's the leadership stuff that oftentimes tends to be the most difficult. But there are times where we are facing challenges where someone comes in and we really don't, it could be anything. Could be anything that's going on. And for example, we can think of COVID. You know, we were hearing about, okay, there's something going on in China. We heard about this virus. It's never going to get here. And then all of a sudden it's here. And then all of a sudden our colleagues are getting sick. How do we respond to this? And our frameworks, they weren't necessarily helpful there. And during those times, organizations, leaders needed to make a decision despite not having all the information that they wanted. And so that is really the decision-making in the crisis of chaos. And so, and there isn't necessarily a correct or incorrect decision there. It's making a decision in the most informed way, using your expertise, understanding that the decision scenario is limited, but you just have to decide and then learn. You learn from the decision that you've made, how the environment reacts, what's going on as other information comes back. And so there are times that, like COVID, again, was a good example, but there are times I think all of us have been through these moments of crisis where all of a sudden the frameworks are falling apart and we need to just step up and decide. And as an emergency physician, it's helpful. My training, I didn't know a lot when I started out and it seemed like everything was chaos and crisis. But over time, you start developing an understanding. Some things become complex. Some things become complicated and there's expertise. And then hopefully things become clear and you develop best practices around them.
Yeah, that makes sense. And there is a distinction perhaps in chaotic environments between perception and reality too, right? There things can be chaotic on the surface, but I guess on one hand can be managed very well with a system or process or experience. And on the other hand, it might be some kind of emotional reaction that you just need to be aware of that it's actually not what it seems on the surface.
Yeah, I'm just giving a vision of the ocean and the calm waters underneath and the waves above.
Mm.
I mean, we can be in the fog and yet there's so much movement around us and chaos, that's oftentimes what's happening. Our vision is finite and we can only see the immediate surroundings, but yet the total environment itself is moving and unknown and ambiguous and ever-changing.
In a past life, I used to be a professional skydiver and was on the U.S. skydiving team for about 4 years and 4,000 skydives in 40 countries and all kinds of interesting scenarios. And the reaction I always get is, as you would imagine, it's like, oh, it's crazy, it's intense. And the reality is that it's a very well-managed environment that's relatively safe.
Right.
Relatively being the key word there. And it's been my experience in most of my life that having to explain that and most people not knowing just because of the perception of it, that it is so dangerous and that it's you know, this incredibly risky thing. You have high stakes, but you have a lot of mitigation that takes place in there. And there's a lot of training and a lot of safety protocol procedure that mitigates all that risk. But it's really interesting to have that experience and then, you know, trying to draw from that to say, okay, you know, like, can you look at this chaotic environment and mitigate against the things that are risky, have a process, system, protocols, and ways to manage that situation so that, to your point before, over time you can stabilize it.
It's funny, in medical school, I went skydiving. And so it was me and my colleagues, and we went skydiving. And just exactly as you're saying, you're not just jumping out of a plane. There's definite steps. And that week, as we were doing our training, and we'd go from medical, you know, class to class, we would jump through the door in a way like we're going to be jumping out of the plane. And it helped us. And it's funny because I can recall one of my classmates, a like tall guy, I think it was like 6'5" with a deep voice. And the area that we were jumping into, this was in Minnesota, it was harvest season. So there's these combines going around. And I remember itchy and scratchy. I just had the idea that we're going to like jump and land in the wrong area and the combine would eat us. It all turned out well. And I remember turning to this tall friend with a deep voice and said, "That was great. What do you think?" And he said, "That was wonderful." His voice was on multiple octaves.
He had a hard opening probably.
That's right.
That's funny. Well, you made it. Congrats.
Yes.
It was a one and done skydive for you?
Honestly, it was one of these things where we had to wait around so long for the weather. It was just like, I can't keep doing this. It took time. But
that's something you don't think about. Yeah. I mean, people's experience of aviation is generally, you know, big airplanes flying at 30,000+ feet that can go through most weather scenarios. And skydiving, they're small planes and small parachutes, and you are very susceptible to wind and weather, and you don't have power under your parachute. So,
true.
All right. Sorry for the tangent there on skydiving. But it's really good. Back to what you're saying about the, you know, the calm under the water and the waves on top. Like, how can we as leaders like help create more stability in these environments for our team? Like, what can you draw from that you think's relevant or valuable?
Yeah, I think just as you bring that up, the calm underneath and the turbulence above is just recognizing that each of us individually goes through this. It's difficult. It's difficult being a leader. And as you're out in front of these situations, we're oftentimes making mistakes. We're learning as we go. And it can be emotionally difficult. It can be physically difficult. And just to realize that our best leaders come from those sorts of situations. And so to be self-accepting and to realize actually those are the points that you learn and you identify different ways and different ways of thinking about things and different ways of processing things. And that makes you more effective. I think just to recognize that. And as a coach, it's one of these great opportunities as I'm coaching colleagues to be able to see, oh, wow, this calm and cool individual, there's actually a lot of turbulence going on you would not see. And just understand that that is so normal. And that actually is something to tap into.
It's a great point. Yeah. And you are an executive coach. So you do this often. And like you said, on the surface, maybe it seems like something, but when you peel it back, they're working through a lot too. And I know that that's common and what you're experiencing and feeling. Maybe as a new leader or experienced leader, that's normal. And to be the best version of a leader you can be for your team, like try your best not to bring whatever you know, you're trying to work through and put that on your team. It's okay to be transparent that maybe you're battling with something, but come from a place of intentional, I think, stability.
Right. Well said.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anything else from the book that you want to share today with the audience that you think would be valuable?
I think the key thing from a leadership perspective and becoming a better leader is reading about leadership and learning from others. And my hope is that the book offers an opportunity for you to learn about some new stuff that are things that I do, but also that unlocks maybe some other perspectives, other authors, individuals that you might pursue, you know, reading more about to improve your ability to lead. So keep reading, keep learning.
Amazing. If there's one thing you could have our listeners take away from our conversation today, what would that be?
I think it's recognize those moments. And that this could be with your kids. It could be with your family. It could be at work. When you're asked a question and how reflexively and quickly you know the answer. And to recognize that during those moments, your expertise may be helpful, or it may be more helpful to not know the answer, to step back and then approach those situations from the perspective of a leader who is a coach and a facilitator. And so trying to develop shared perspective and shared reality, asking questions, discovering, finding new solutions, as opposed to stepping forward and pointing out the direction from your limited, albeit experienced, perspective.
Love that. That's awesome. If the listeners want to pick up your book, and I hope they do, if they want to find you on social or anywhere that you have a presence, where can they find your book and where can they connect with you?
Yeah, the book's available in any store. It's on audiobook and electronic and also in hardback. And so it's You're the Leader, Now What? And then you can find me at my very creatively named website, richardwinters.com. And there you can see links for social media. I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks so much for doing this with us today. And it was a lot of really valuable insight. And I hope our listeners enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the One Thing Podcast. If you're a bold risk taker who wants to dream big and achieve a higher level of success in your life or business, visit theonething.com. There you'll find information on one-on-one coaching, our exclusive community membership program, and customized workshops that will help you get your team or organization aligned and rowing in the same direction. That's the1.com to start living the life you've always dreamed of today. Be sure to follow the show to stay up to date on weekly episodes, guest interviews, and more. Plus, we would love to hear from you. Send us a voice note by going to speakpipe.com/theonething or email us at podcast@theonething.com. We'll see you next week.